Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Eric Motley, and I'm an executive vice president here at the Aspen Institute. My parents. Which gives me all the more pleasure in inviting you to our campus and welcoming you to the last in the McCloskey's speaker series for this summer. Nothing that is done here on campus programmatically is done without the support of individuals. And so I want to recognize Tom and Bonnie McCloskey and thank you for this series. Bonnie is one of our trustees here at the Aspen Institute, so she's constantly watching to make sure that we're performing and living into our mission. But we can't live within our mission without other supporters. I see trustees who are here and many of our SOF supporters, and I'd like to thank you for the support that you've given us to create a wonderful summer worth of programming that has been both intellectually stimulating and provocative. We have an extraordinary panel here tonight, but before I introduce them to you, I want to recognize one or two governors who are in the audience. We have Governor Mary Phelan, who's here. Ah, what an arrival, Governor. Perfect timing. We're very happy to have you with us. We have Governor Gary Herbert from Utah, who's with us. And Governor Doug Ducey from the state of Arizona. And Governor Ducey is actually one of us. He is a Rodel Scholar Fellow of the Aspen Institute, which is a program designed to bring together nonpartisan leaders in politics from all across the country who work together to try to find the most viable solutions to some of the most complex problems in society. So we're very happy to have you here on campus. We're also very fortunate to have with us four great leaders, exceptional leaders, who will engage us in a conversation, a very timely conversation tonight, and they're seated right behind me. And allow me to introduce you. Governor Matt Bevin.
Governor?
The governor was elected the governor of the Commonwealth of Kentucky in 2015. He attended Washington and Lee University on an ROTC scholarship. Upon graduating, he served as an active duty officer in the United States Army. After his military service, Governor Bevin worked for many years in the financial industry, then focused on founding several companies ranging from manufacturing to investment management to medical devices. We also have with us Governor Lawrence Hogan Jr. The governor was inaugurated as the 67th governor of the state of Maryland in 2015. For more than 25 years, Governor Hogan worked in the private sector as a successful Maryland businessman. As governor, he has made record investments in both education, transportation, and enacted some of the most important environmental initiatives in our generation regarding Chesapeake Bay. Thank you so much, Governor. The last governor is Governor Pete Ricketts, who was born and sworn in Nebraska as the 40th governor in 2015. Prior to his election as governor, he worked to support Nebraska entrepreneurs and startup companies. He is a past board chair of TD Ameritrade's board of directors, as well as the founder of Draken, which supports local entrepreneurs and startup companies. And finally, our dear friend, Ann Korologos, who's going to moderate the panel. Ann was the Secretary of Labor under President Ronald Reagan, but among many other things, she has served in numerous government positions. She's a member of the board of directors of many blue chip companies, including Michael Kors, AMR Corporation, Harman International, and Kellogg Company. She currently serves as the chairman of the board of Anderson Ranch, and in addition to running and serving on many boards, she's a successful art gallerist, director, and owner down in Basalt, the Ann Korologos Gallery. But most importantly, whether or not she'll note it, she was the first female and the only female chairman of the Aspen Institute and serves as chairman emeritus of our board. Thank you, Ann, and thank you, governors.
Thank you, Eric. And if we can move the podium, everyone will be able to meet Governor Bevin in a minute. While we're doing that, I'll just tell you that when Walter Isaacson emailed me and then called me about moderating this panel, I wrote him back quickly, and I said, I'm happy to do it, but do you think all this Republican stuff I'm doing is going to hurt my gallery in any way? And he emailed in a nanosecond and said, Ann, you have to understand, Democrats make art, Republicans buy it. It's a great system. So I'm here today and honored to be with these three governors. We had a chance to visit just before we came out. You're in for a great, great afternoon, I think. But I'd like to, another Walter admonition is get the news out of the way first. The theme of this is a state's eye view of America in 2016 and beyond. So we're going to deal with 2016 right off the bat. And so 2016 is upon us. Is Trump winning Governor Bevins in Kentucky? And are you endorsing him and supporting him?
So how about Governor Ricketts from Nebraska? How about this guy? How about him? There were three questions wedged in there. I guess I could afford to miss one or two of them and focus on whether Trump is winning in Kentucky.
Just move it on to me real quickly, just like you tried to do.
Bottom line, this is, and let's be honest with ourselves, this has turned out to be a don't ask, don't tell type of year. It really has. I don't care which side you're on. It's that kind of a year politically. And so in some measure, your question, is he winning in Kentucky? He is, and he will win Kentucky handily. I have not endorsed him. I will vote for him. I see this as a very clear choice. This is a binary issue. And again, I did not endorse him on purpose. I have issues, as do others, with any number of things. Those don't need to be adjudicated at this point. I'll simply say this. This is a very clear choice. And for those among us who might want to tease ourselves into thinking that somehow there are alternatives to the two choices, we're going to have a Hillary Clinton or a Donald Trump as the president of the United States. It is binary. It's not a crossroads. It's a fork in the road. We're going to go one way or the other. And there will be direct, very specific ramifications associated with whatever choice we take. And it will either be a more regulated, bigger government, more intrusiveness into your lives type of a government, or it will have the potential to be less likely. And it's not just the Supreme Court, it's the EPA, and it's the IRS, and it's a fill in the blank. And that is the choice. And if we think otherwise, we are deluding ourselves. So.
Governor, thank you for that short answer. And I think they also told me collectively they know how not to answer questions. So, Governor Ricketts, how about in Nebraska? It's a red state, I believe. How's Trump going to fare there?
Well, I have not seen any polling numbers per se, but as you point out, Nebraska tends to be pretty red. It's actually a pretty populous state as well, which also, frankly, plays to Donald Trump's message. So I expect that he will win there pretty handily. That's going to happen pretty handily. I actually endorsed Donald Trump when he became the presumptive nominee because he had a rally the next day in Nebraska, and I'm on his ag advisory team. Nebraska is an agricultural state, and certainly one of the things that if we do have Donald Trump as president, I want to have an impact, for example, when he talks about trade, because trade is incredibly important to Nebraska. And in fact, I had a chance to talk to him shortly before he did his rally in Nebraska and said, hey, I want to talk to you about a couple issues, trade being one of them, because you've been very anti-trade. And let me tell you, it really benefits Nebraska quite a bit and why the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership is going to be so beneficial. And one of the things that really struck me is that in private, he is very charming and his public persona is really quite different, right? He comes off as being very bombastic. But when I was talking to him privately, he was asking questions, taking notes, listening, and in fact incorporated some of the things we talked about, specifically about trade, in his remarks at the rally and in an interview I saw him do right after we talked. So that's really, I think, what I expect to see if Donald Trump gets to be president, is that he will surround himself with good people and listen to them. And when you talk about the Supreme Court, for example, he's put out who he would expect to be those nominees. So you can go out and see. If you don't like those people, then you've got a good indication on whether or not you're going to think Donald Trump would be a good person to pick the Supreme Court. So I think that some of those things really are going to be playing in his favor. And, of course, you know, campaigns do matter, and after Labor Day, people will really start paying attention.
So you don't see any slippage yet, like some are saying they're starting to feel?
Well, I think it's a bit premature to start going into. If you're a Trump supporter, I think it's a little bit premature to start getting worried, as I think the race really starts going hot and heavy in after Labor Day. But like I said, campaigns matter. Campaigns matter, and Donald Trump, just like every other candidate who's come before him, has got to figure out not only how to secure his base, but also pull in the middle part of that base. And I think that, you know, remains to be seen.
Okay, thank you. Governor Hogan, I think you have a different story to tell.
Well, thanks for starting with the softball questions. And thank you guys for filibustering and eating up all the time so I can give a shorter answer.
Yeah, it's time we move on to the next question.
I think it's time we move on. My state is a little bit different. I happen to represent the bluest state in the entire country. I'm the second Republican governor elected there in 50 years. The last time our... last time that our state voted for a Republican presidential candidate was Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Smart state.
And I would say that Donald Trump is not going to win Maryland. It's a pretty safe assumption. He's probably going to lose by 30 points in our state. And I did not endorse and haven't gotten involved. I've stayed really active in the bipartisan effort to turn my state around and not focused on national politics.
Good for you. Thank you. With that out of the way, let's talk about Republican governors. There's a whole group with the Republican Governors Association here. I welcome you all. And one of the things you know, and most people may forget, there are 31 governors, 18 Democrats and one independent, 31 Republican, 18 Democrats, one independent. 12 states have governor elections this year, 8 Democrats, 4 Republicans. It's well known and documented that it's very hard to unseat a sitting governor. I think 5 in the past few years have been unseated. And concurrently with this election, just the 4 Republicans. We can talk about the 5 that are safe in the Democrats' side, 4 that are safe or leaning in the Republican, 3 toss-up. So whatever happens, I salute Fred Malek and the Republican Governors Association. We've got a solid group of governors out there. And governors, as we said earlier, you do things. You're close to your customer. You're all businessmen. You're close to your customer. You're listening to the people. You empty garbage and you control schools and you send out the National Guard when you have to. But a little known fact is also that state legislatures, numbers are pretty interesting. 5,920 of the country's 7,383 state legislature seats are for election in the presidential year. 68 state chambers are under GOP control, and Democrats have 30 chambers. Sort of interesting. When people ask, how's the Republican Party doing? It's doing very well. So the question I have is, what's the impact of the Trump candidacy, or a different way of putting it, for the future, perhaps, on a Clinton presidency, on the 30-plus governors, and I'm talking to 3 here now, but on your states? How do you look ahead, or do you just keep yourself in control of your state, of your legislature, if you can, and of the agenda you've set? Governor Bevins.
You know, governors have a responsibility. They're chief executives of their respective states. It is an executive role, not a legislative or deliberative role. We have to get things done. When there are riots, there is a response needed. When there are floods, there is a response needed. When there is homelessness, it needs to be addressed. When there is a budget shortfall, it needs to be resolved. These are not things you get to debate. They are things that of necessity must be taken care of. And so to that end, we don't have the luxury of being ideological to the nth degree. We can have our ideology, and I certainly do. I'm a conservative person. I'm the 4th Republican since the 1800s in Kentucky. We don't do this very often. But I will say this. I ran with an expectation. I was very clear in my message. I ran on a very fiscally conservative approach. There were 7 tenets. and they were all fiscal in nature. They were about addressing the pensions and taxes and right-to-work legislation and tort reform and school choice and things of this nature. None of the above of which we've had for ever in Kentucky. I have the only house in the South that is still controlled by Democrats. So there was an expectation that I would be handcuffed, that I would not be able to get things done. And yet, that's not acceptable. We have the worst funded pension system in America. That was something that needed to be addressed. It wasn't a partisan issue. It was something that needed to be addressed. And so that and a number of other things I had to move forward on with a sense of purpose. I've been governor now for about 8 months. And yet it isn't easy as that. Just doing the right thing is not always easy. Partisanship does matter. And it will matter who is elected at the highest level, depending on how things flow forward. But all I'll say is I've been sued by, you know, at least a dozen times now. I've been sued by my own attorney general several times in the last 6 months. I've been sued by the Speaker of our House. I've been sued by several other state legislators. Anything they don't like, they sue me for because their friends are in the courts and they know they'll win the first level. And then they hope to then settle with you and never actually see law being definitively resolved. What I think we have the responsibility to do as governors is recognize that there is a sovereignty to states, that there is an autonomy to states, and that the 10th Amendment, which delineates the fact that those powers not given to the federal government, which are fewer and enumerated, are the responsibility of the states and of the people. And we had better, sure as blazes, regardless of who the next president is, take this seriously. Because it is our responsibility to recognize the fact that it was the states that created the federal government and not the other way around.
Thank you. Governor Ricketts, I can't ask you the first question without it being this one. The Cubs are 12 games ahead in the National League Central with 46 games to play. 108 years ago, they won the World Series. Is this the Cubs' year?
Well, anybody can have a bad century. But just so you know, Ann, that's not actually how we think about it. What we think about is, and politics and baseball are my two favorite subjects, so we can talk about either for a long time. We think about it as being consistently good. If we go to the playoffs 7 out of 10 years, we will go to the World Series. So we're not trying to put all the pressure on the team to go this year. It's about get to the postseason. Once you get to the postseason, anything can happen. Remember the Cardinals 5 years ago? Last game of the season, got in, wild card, won the whole thing. That's the postseason. So our strategy is consistently be good and get to the postseason. To get to be consistently good, however, we had to change the culture. You know, this idea of lovable losers, that was the Cubs organization. They weren't doing anything meaningful to allow themselves to win, to be good. And so we had to come in to change a culture. We had, because that's what we had to do, is change a culture. We brought in new people, and we started demanding accountability and excellence. We started measuring what people were doing, setting goals, holding them accountable for reaching those goals. And that's how we were able to start changing the way the Cubs thought about how they did business, both on the baseball side and on the business side. Both sides of that house needed to be reformed, revamped. And frankly, it's the same sort of thing right now that I'm trying to do in Nebraska. Bring about a culture change there as well in state government. To bring about the things that we do in the private sector to demand accountability and excellence, put measurements in place. Crazy things like job descriptions for cabinet heads, annual review processes. These are things that didn't exist before. Measurements for the agencies. So by holding people accountable and demanding excellence and setting goals, we're going to change the culture in state government just like we did at the Cubs. Do you like how I turned it back around like that?
That's the way you're going. I'm going to ask the Governor Hogan if he's going to buy the Orioles in a minute. But just to finish, some of the things that maybe people don't know that I found interesting, the fourth article of the Nebraska Constitution calls you the supreme executive power of Nebraska.
I wish it were that easy.
Well, I know you. Executive power.
He gets a cape and everything. It's awesome.
Comes with a crown.
But unlike your two colleagues, you also have a unicameral legislature. And how are you doing with that? And you're probably closer to how Washington functions than you are to how your colleagues are functioning, even with all the lawsuits. Am I right?
Well, Larry told me I can't whine about the unicameral too much. Okay. So Nebraska has a unique system of legislature. We're the only state that has a unicameral. It's a nonpartisan body. And I will say that, actually talking to colleagues, I'm told that it's less polarized than other state houses around the country. But having said that, if you've all read Federalist 51, you know James Madison laid out that a one-house legislature puts the executive at a huge disadvantage. And so no matter what they write in the Constitution about being the supreme executive, those legislators don't think that, I can tell you that. And so it really is a challenge. I'm the only check and balance in the system. That in a two-house system, you've got a House and a Senate that are playing off against each other. There's a check and balance there. A bad bill maybe passes in the House. The Senate says, that's their problem, it's not my bad bill, and it dies. Well, that doesn't happen in a unicameral. There's a vote train goes on in every legislature, but there's a lot more bills that get passed and then hit my desk that I've got to be the check and balance on. So I think it does put more pressure on the executive, and it creates unique challenges. But like I said, it's also probably less polarized than maybe other state houses. So there's a trade-off, you know, in any system, and that's just the one that we deal with in Nebraska.
I want to come back with all of you in a minute. I'll finish with Governor Hogan on this question. A little more specificity, as you touched on some of the things you're doing. It strikes me as businessmen that you've taken on the governing with in mind, as I said, the close to the customer, but you're tax cutters. You're reform-oriented. You're cutting red tape. You're thinking about various programs to reform some of the systems that you found so inadequate. So we'll come back and allow you to even do more of your wonderful explaining of your programs. But Governor Hogan, you're our neighbor in Washington, D.C. To Maryland. You've got a large amount of federal workers in Maryland, and yet you've come in, as you pointed out, as the second Republican governor in nearly 50 years. And you came in after having founded Change Maryland, advocating lower taxes, less government, public engagement, bipartisanship. Talk a little bit about how you've been able to do that, living so close to Washington, D.C., which seems to be the opposite of everything you're doing, and how can those of us who are in Washington benefit more by your infiltrating, perhaps, across that border?
Well, it's a great question. Thank you. So our state was way off track and heading in the wrong direction. Over the past 8 years, we had lost 8,600 businesses, 200,000 jobs. There was a poll that said nearly half of all Marylanders wanted to leave the state. And that was something that was frustrating, not just Republicans. Our state only has 26% Republican. There were Democrats and independents who were just as frustrated about the direction that our state was heading. And we focused on economic issues, and I created a nonpartisan organization. We didn't really have much of a Republican Party, and I didn't want to get 26% of the vote. So I formed an organization called Change Maryland, and we just talked about the issues that everyone agreed on. People wanted to put our economy back on track. They wanted to get our state heading in the right direction. They want more jobs. They felt overtaxed. We had, in Maryland, raised taxes 87 times in a row, increased taxes by $10 billion, and it had crushed our economy and caused all these businesses, jobs, and taxpayers to flee the state. So we focused on that, and I tried never to get into a partisan battle. I tried to stay focused on the issues, because I believe, as I'm talking to people all around the state of Maryland, whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat or you're an independent, you're really frustrated with the partisanship, particularly in Washington, but all around the country. They don't like the name-calling, the finger-pointing. They want what they want, and what most people want, are bipartisan, common-sense solutions to the real problems, and they want people to get things done. They want people to say what they're going to do and then do what they say, and that's what we've tried to do. So I took off office January of last year. We eliminated 90% of a $5.3 billion structural deficit. We put a $200 million income tax refund. We cut taxes by $700 million. We lowered tolls, first time in 50 years, by $270 million. We cut 255 fees all across state government, cut regulations. The result has been a dramatic turnaround in Maryland. We went from last place in the Mid-Atlantic region in job creation to first place in the Mid-Atlantic region in job creation. In the month of March, we went to number one in the nation. Our small state of Maryland created 19,000 jobs in 1 month, more than any big state in the country. So we've gone from one of the worst to one of the best in the country. It was the best year for businesses in Maryland in over a decade, and people are now happy with the direction. So even though I'm a Republican in the bluest state in the country, you know, more than two-thirds of Marylanders now believe we're heading in the right direction, and nearly three-quarters of them approve of the job that we've been doing.
It's a Are you getting competitive, all of you?
No, I was just saying, what a bragger.
What did you guys do?
Hey, you know, it ain't bragging if it's true, though. And it's the truth.
And it's true. Let me stay with Governor Hogan for a minute and then go back down the line and just ask a couple of follow-up questions on your state. Do you want to bring us up to date on Baltimore and what happened last April and then with the DOJ last week?
Sure. So I had just been elected governor, the first time I've ever held office. I'd been in the job for 90 days, and you know, I had an agenda, was focused on turning our economy around. I had a lot of things that we had planned for. That was something that we had not planned for. 90 days in, we had the worst violence in 47 years in our city. Our largest and most important city was in flames. Quickly overwhelmed the city government. We had, in just the first few hours, 400 businesses were burned, looted, and destroyed. There were 170 police and firefighters who were injured. There was chaos in the city. And I immediately declared a state of emergency and sent in 1,000 state troopers and 4,000 members of the National Guard. We showed the force, but didn't use the force. We brought the people into the city to try to keep people safe, but we allowed people to protest for a week. We just stopped all the violence. I spent the entire week walking the city, walking every single neighborhood, trying to restore the calm and the peace. I worked with community leaders and faith-based leaders. The next morning, after the riots broke out and the city was on fire, I was there at sunrise at North End. If you watched on CNN or Fox where the CVS was burned, I was there hugging people who were cleaning out their homes and their stores, which have been looted. Then I went to Freddie Gray's neighborhood in Sandtown and talked to his neighbors and family and friends. And we spent the entire week, we restored peace and calm to the city of Baltimore. And our team did an incredible job. And we're now, we just had a seminar a month ago at National Governors Association where they asked me to talk about our response there. And we're actually, you know, teaching people around the nation how to respond to a crisis. But you know, they didn't really teach me that at New Governor School. It was instinctive. And we just acted. Baltimore's got serious problems, and as most large cities do, but we're really focused on trying to see what we can do. The DOJ report that just came out obviously pointed a lot of fingers at you know, past administrations, particularly while Martin O'Malley was mayor of Baltimore, where most of the criticism went, but the police department's got a lot of work to do. In this last legislative session, we passed a Justice Reinvestment Act. It was a bipartisan, hardly negotiated with Democrats and Republicans to reform our justice system. We talk about lowering recidivism, talk about second chance for people that want to put their lives back on track, things that a lot of Republicans don't usually talk about. We're making progress, but you know, you can't fix all the problems of urban America in a short period of time. It's taken, you know, more than 50 years to get to this part, but we're doing everything we can. We're investing record numbers in education, job training programs. I just put $100 million into the city of Baltimore for blight removal. We've got 19,000 empty row houses there that are, you know, not only eyesore, but a hotbed for crime and drugs. And
you also, I think, have money you put in for heroin, fighting heroin addiction. And yeah. I think all of you are dealing in some way with the drug and opiate phenomenon to me. But
well, as I was running for governor, the biggest surprise for me was, as I was traveling around, I went to all of our counties, some were urban, suburban, very rural. Everywhere I went, I would say, what's the number one issue facing your county or your community? And I was shocked that the number one issue everywhere was heroin and opioids. We have a little place called Caroline County, which is our most rural county on the eastern shore of Maryland. I thought they were gonna talk about agriculture issues, or maybe some transportation needs, and they said their county was overrun with heroin. And I went to a southern Maryland small town where they said 90% of their crime and the people in jails were heroin related. So we decided to focus on it. I talked about it a lot during the campaign. Right after I was elected, I appointed our lieutenant governor to head up a heroin and opioid abuse task force. We brought all kinds of professionals together, held hearings all around the state. They came up with recommendations, 33 recommendations, to try to attack this problem from all directions, from the treatment side, from the medical side, and from the criminal side. So we've now got RICO statutes that we can take down gangs and criminal enterprises like you could under federal law. But we also put more money into treatment programs. And this is a problem that is affecting and tearing apart families and communities all across America. And I know a lot of other governors are focused on it as well.